But first today, there is no app for happiness. So reads the title of Max Strom's new book that examines what holds us back from being happier people. Turns out that one big obstacle is technology, which has only made many of us more depressed, anxious, sleep-deprived, and over-medicated. Max Strom is all about encouraging people to retake control of their lives. He teaches personal transformation and yoga worldwide. He talks about the emotional and spiritual aspects of our lives, as well as physical healing. Max is in town for workshops this weekend in connection with the Yoga Gallery out in downtown Overland Park. And Max, so good to have you back again. Welcome back to
Great.
Kansas City.
Hey, thank you.
Well, you were here almost exactly a year ago, Max, talking about some of these ideas. In the year that's just passed, have you seen society get a better handle on technology and, you know, turn the corner to becoming happier, or have things only gotten worse? And I think I can predict your answer here. Am I right?
Yeah, I think you are right. Statistically, I think we are becoming a more unhappy society.
Yeah.
And we can't go by statistics where they ask people if they're happy, because people aren't always truthful and sometimes don't know the indications of unhappiness themselves. But if you look at the amount of medications people are taking now for blood pressure,
yeah,
for depression, anxiety, sleep, et cetera, they're all spiking.
Yeah. I was going to say, you say in the book that the evidence that most of us are struggling to find happiness is just overwhelming. Here's one piece of it from your book, and you write this: we are turning to pharmaceuticals en masse and have become a medicated society of unprecedented proportions. In fact, Max, you say that one in four women in this country takes antidepressants. One in four?
Well, that was a year ago.
Yeah.
So it's probably more now.
Wow.
Yeah, and in Saudi Arabia, it's one in two. It's 50%.
No kidding.
Yeah, so people, I think we have this assumption that this will level off, but I don't see it leveling off. I think it's getting worse. And, of course, thank God we live in a time where we have these medications, because some people truly need them.
Of course.
Chemical,
yeah,
imbalances.
Mm-hmm.
But now it's becoming more of a lifestyle drug, like taking aspirin if you have a headache. If doctors will even say, you know, if you – how are you feeling? And you say, oh, it's been a hard year. People, mm-hmm, have been passing away, and they say, oh, I'll write you something for that, and they'll hand you a prescription,
yes,
for antidepressants.
Mm-hmm. Happens almost automatically now.
Yes, yes.
I mean, that's one measure of it. Another way that you look at it in this book is you point out that everybody's got cell phones, but you also say that most people remained starved for intimacy. What an interesting juxtaposition there.
It is, and it's funny that we're trying to use technology to get more intimacy. And there are so many books on intimacy. And when I mean intimacy, I don't just mean romantic intimacy. I mean friendship, community.
Just connecting.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And it's certainly true that technology has aided us in becoming connected more often with more people around the world. I don't begrudge that at all. I'm for it. But it is a superficial connection. I mean, I travel a lot, 200 days a year. And I can tell you that speaking on the phone with my wife is not the same as being there.
Isn't that the truth?
Texting is worse.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm,
being in her presence is what I want, just to hold her hand and talk to her. It's not the same through technology.
You know, I was going to say, as you travel the country, are you seeing this, you know, this lack of intimacy, this reaching out for connection, this so many folks being depressed? I gather you see it all right in front of your eyes almost every day.
Yes. In industrial cities from Beijing to Berlin to Tel Aviv, it's pretty much the same. But it's the worst here in America.
No kidding. Mm. And that would be because?
I just think this is the place where it's all originated. And, you know, we market things so heavily here.
Mm-hmm. So in the book, you talk about this striving for happiness and what folks have to do to sort of begin to embrace that idea more fully. You say that people only have a vague idea of what it is that happiness actually is.
This is actually really fascinating, because when I sit in front of people and talk to them or give lectures, and I see, tens of thousands of people a year, and I talk to them about the subject of happiness in seminars, I find that people are extremely inarticulate. Now, if you think about it for a minute, about what we are articulate about, like, what's your favorite sports team? Tell me about the Jets. Tell me about the Kansas City Chiefs. People can speak with encyclopedic knowledge about their sports team, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Absolutely.
And there's nothing wrong with that.
Nothing wrong with that.
But if someone turns to you and says, well, what makes you happy? And suddenly you realize you haven't explained that to anybody ever. People become this, like inarticulate 12-year-olds. I received an email the other day from a student who said, "You are the first person in my life to ask me what makes me happy." This is how seldom we discuss it. I think the reason is we have this unspoken agreement that success brings happiness. So we talk a lot about getting successful, making money, power, get your kids in the right schools, because that will make them happy. But studies have shown that once you have the basic necessities in life, beyond that, money does not make you happy. Two houses doesn't make you twice as happy as one.
You say we're not taught how to be happy.
That's right.
We don't. We go through our lives and never really discuss such a central pivot point in all of our lives.
Yes. People, if you ask them what list of priorities, how high is happiness, I think most people would say it's number one or number two, right? Number one maybe would be living forever. Mm-hmm. Number two would be happy. But, I mean, in your own life, have you ever been handed a handbook as a child?
No.
Received mentorship? Had a class offered in school? No.
And what a missed opportunity, which is your point here.
Yes, missed opportunity. So we're confusing now, I think, happiness with entertainment.
Yeah.
We're so entertained, I think we can't tell the difference.
We're visiting with yoga master Max Strom about his new book, There Is No App for Happiness. The subtitle of your book is How to Avoid a Near-Life Experience, and that refers to what?
Near-death experience.
Near-death experience.
We all know what that is.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But a near-life experience is getting to the end of your life with a lot of regrets and realizing I could have done so much more. I should have said I love you when I had the chance. I should have taken more risks. I squandered an opportunity called a lifetime.
And yet you say we're programmed to be happy. It's inside all of us.
Yes, I do think so. It does take some courage to be intimate. It takes courage to look into people's eyes and to be vulnerable and tell them what you really feel. And unfortunately, through technology, it allows us sort of a social excuse to look down. Like if I'm nervous, let's say I'm a little bit of a nervous person, self-conscious, which I was as a teenager. If I was a teenager now, I would have an excuse to look down and not have to make eye contact. Mm-hmm. So it encourages us to withdraw. It doesn't encourage us to rise above our timidity.
You know, it is amazing to me as you walk around, whether it's campus, walk around downtown Kansas City, these days more and more people I find, you pass them on the street, you make eye contact, and they're not looking back. They're looking down. They're looking somewhere else. People just saying hello, that seems to be just absolutely out the window these days.
Yes. Yeah. Everybody says they want more intimacy, more community, but we are isolating ourselves. Like it's almost like we're in a solitary confinement in a prison, tapping on pipes, trying to communicate with somebody somewhere.
Yeah, that's what it's come down to. We're visiting with Max Strom. He'll be conducting workshops Friday through Sunday at Patty Furman's Yoga Gallery in downtown Overland Park. These are for beginning all the way through more advanced practitioners. More information, just go to yogagallery.com. That's yogallery.com. Max, okay, you talk about these three imperatives in the book aimed at taking back control of our lives. The first is self-study, which involves overcoming your negative presets. What does that mean, overcoming your negative presets?
A negative preset is something that's imprinted onto us. For example, if you lived in a house when you were a child, if your parents were angered, or there's codependency, or there's a lot of anxiety or alcoholism. These things are what we grew up in. We didn't have a choice, and now they still affect us as adults. Those are negative presets.
And you overcome them how?
Well, the first way is to understand that we have them. I think it's what I call your blind side. Mm-hmm. And our blind side is a part of us that everybody around us knows we have except for us. It's almost like when you were a kid and you stick a note on someone's back that said, idiot, and everybody would see the note except the person wearing it. You know, it's like, for example, you might think your husband is not as funny as he thinks he is because he thinks he's really funny, but everybody around him tolerates his jokes. Mm-hmm. They love him in spite of his jokes, not because of them. We all have stuff like that.
Yeah.
Or we might sabotage ourselves in different ways. So self-awareness exercises, such as going to therapy, is if one can afford it, our first steps to understanding how am I sabotaging myself, keeping myself from being happy. And an exercise that I advocate very strongly is to consult your peers and give them the opportunity to give you critique on your strengths, your gifts, and your weaknesses.
Boy, that takes courage, though.
It does, but if we don't do it, we're going to be in denial our whole life.
Do you find, you know, what, lots of people just simply lacking a basic sense of self-awareness?
Oh, very much so, yes.
Yeah.
And this shows up, of course, in the decline of manners in our society, the decline of politeness. That's called consideration. I consider how my actions are going to impact you and my neighbor.
Mm-hmm. So people do that. Do you find people are willing to take that step and ask their friends, ask their peers to say, hey, assess me in some, you know, try to be objective and give me a sense of really who I am?
Some people are, but most people are terrified.
Oh, boy, no kidding.
But here's what I tell people to encourage them, because this is, it'll be the best thing you've ever done.
Mm-hmm.
And here's the surprising part of it. When people come back to me and they say, I finally, after 2 years, got up the courage to do that exercise you taught us. You know, I consulted 5 of my friends, and what I was shocked to find out was what they thought my gifts were. They knew pretty much mostly what their negative presets were or their blind sides. They weren't shocked, but they're shocked when someone says, you know, you're wasting your time doing this. You should be doing that. You're so talented. Why aren't you doing this? And we all think this, but we never wanted to impose our opinion on you. And so sometimes they're catapulted into a new direction in their life based on positive reinforcement, not negative.
You know, it's one thing for someone to ask friends to be frank about, you know, your strengths and weaknesses. The other thing is it does put something of a burden on the friends to be honest and objective and candid with the person who's asking. That takes almost an equal amount of courage coming back the other way.
And it also creates a stronger bond with your friend.
Hmm.
There are certain rules. You can't ever interrupt them. You can't defend yourself, tell them why you do what you do. You just listen. I recommend recording it so you have it forever and you can listen back.
Oh, that's interesting. Because you're going to forget.
That's
right. Your mind's going to block some things you don't want to hear.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
That's right. And the reason you have to do it with several friends, not just one, is it's, let's say you and I do it. I ask you, Steve, help me out with this. And you say, well, Max, you tend to procrastinate. I can leave and I think, well, that's his opinion. You know, that's how Steve is. But if 5 friends say, I procrastinate, it's a fact.
You got an issue.
I have an issue. I can't argue it.
Imperative number 2, Max Strom, live as if your time and your lifespan were the same thing, meaning?
Have you noticed that we have a different language for time and for life? If we talk about a life, it's precious, right? We have all these words like precious. It's something to be taken care of, protected at all costs. It's all we have. I'll die for you. We talk about time. It's, yeah, I've got time to kill tonight. What do you want to do?
Mm-hmm.
And there's a total
disconnect.
Total disconnect. Mm-hmm. Whereas, you know, is your life important? Yes. What did you do today? I spent 6 hours blowing up spaceships on a video game. and how did that change your life?
Mm-hmm.
It didn't change my life.
And so you're suggesting what? That people take a very serious, sober look at how they spend their time and what they're doing with it?
Yes. You have to understand that your time and your lifespan are exactly the same thing. And so I call it lifespan management instead of time management. And if you start thinking of it as these are my precious hours, you'll use them better. And I'm not saying you should never entertain yourself or do fun things or go to a game or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
We all need diversion sometimes. But since entertainment is being sold to us constantly now, it's run amok where the average American watches TV 4 hours a day, then they would play their video games for a couple of hours a day, and then they're online, and then they're on their phone,
mm-hmm.
to where, well, when are you actually doing something that, A, is going to have meaningful impact on you, and B, be with people that you love?
Yeah, how powerful a realization is that when people take that self-assessment and they, you know, think that, wow, I didn't realize I was spending so much time with video games or whatever the thing is. Does that really shock people into sort of changing their behavior?
I don't know. I don't know that many people personally that play video games for long periods of time.
You and I aren't of that same
no.
that age cohort. We're in a different place, aren't
yes.
we? Yeah. Yeah. All right. Imperative number three, learn a daily regime that heals, empowers you, and practice it 1 hour a day. You're talking about what?
Well, I'm talking about something like yoga, qigong, or something like that. So it has to include breathing, a breathing regime, not just movement. So this doesn't count. People say, well, I jog and I breathe while I jog. Yeah, but a lot of the joggers that I know, especially the marathon runners, are the most stressed out people I know. They're type A, and they don't sleep well, and they're it's almost like they're running away from something as opposed to towards something.
I've noticed that too.
Yeah, and we can't go on machines like life cycles and treadmills and watch the news. That is not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about a type of exercise where you do movement that builds strength and flexibility, because flexibility triggers the relaxation response. That's what helps you sleep and be nicer to people. Not that anybody needs it. 80 million people are taking sleep medication every night now. And the breath work, that you breathe in a certain way while you do it, calms your nervous system down even more and makes you feel very present. There's a lot of talk now in the metaphysical world, self-development world, on being in the now. But to be in the now, I think two things are required. One is you need to learn how to breathe, because that keeps you, your mind, fixed on one thing without having to force it. But two, an under-discussed topic is reconciling with your past. And I know that sounds odd, perhaps, but when you do a breathing practice, emotions that you've repressed are released. These repressed emotions, such as grief, really affect our behavior.
You're talking about learning how to breathe, and you talked about that a year ago when you were here. What are you talking about, learning how to breathe, Max Strom? What does that mean?
Well,
because everyone's thinking, I know how to breathe, buddy. Thanks a lot. Yeah,
right. Yeah. I hear that a lot.
Yeah.
I'm breathing now.
Look at me. I'm doing it pretty well. Yeah.
Well, we're moving now, too. As you and I speak, we're moving our body a little bit, moving our arms, but we're not exercising. So we know that when we move our body in a certain way, with repetition, it changes our body, whether it's stretching or building strength. Similarly, if you breathe in a certain way with repetition, it has an effect on the nervous system. So it's conscious breathing rather than what we're doing almost all the time, which is subconscious breathing.
So conscious breathing, meaning you're aware of what you're doing, you're thinking about it as you're doing it?
Yes. For instance, the most common breath we use in yoga sounds like this. That was an inhale. So I made that sound in my throat, which slowed down the breath. Mm-hmm. It's like a nozzle on a hose. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't, you know, you can inhale in half a second. So I made the inhale last 5 or 6 seconds. I exhale the same way. You do this with repetition for an hour. Yeah, and your nervous system becomes very calm, not stupid calm, not I need to go to sleep calm, alert calm, which is something most people don't experience anymore. Mm-hmm.
How difficult is it to learn this, to make this transformation from unconscious breathing to conscious breathing?
I don't think it's really that difficult. When I teach beginner's classes, some people get it in the very first class.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like riding a bicycle. It's a little bit tricky at first, and you have it.
Mm-hmm.
And then you refine it gradually over time. And then there are powerful breathing exercises that we do on specific occasions, which are more purging, where they releases, for example, old grief. And, you know, when I talk about this, people are surprised sometimes. They say, I don't hold emotions in my body. And I ask them, well, have you heard of post-traumatic stress syndrome? I mean, soldiers come back from combat. They can't sleep. They can't function sometimes because things that happened before at a different time, they're still carrying with them, and it haunts them. And a lot of us have things like that, even if you weren't in combat. Mm-hmm. We've had divorce, death, things that really affect us.
Yeah. So the way to change the world, you're saying, is to begin by changing yourself.
Yes. And if that sounds surprising to you, I want you to consider something. Are greed, corruption, war, slavery, racism, are those technological problems? Are we going to solve those with better technology?
Mm-hmm.
I think those problems that essentially plague humanity are going to remain with us no matter what we build technologically.
Yeah.
Those are personal issues. Those are personal actions, choices, and points of view. So the world's not really going to change until we change ourselves.
We're visiting with Max Strom. He's a yoga master. He's in town conducting workshops Friday through Sunday at Patty Furman's Yoga Gallery in downtown Overland Park. These are, you know, for beginners, for more advanced practitioners. More information, yogagallery.com. That's YOGALLERY.com, yogagallery.com. You know, Max, you mentioned yoga a few minutes ago, and we talked a little bit again about this a year ago, but you're a large guy, and I've done enough yoga to know it's always fascinating for me. People think of yoga, you tend to think of people who are incredibly limber. In my mind, I think of more women than I do men because they seem to be more flexible than men are. You're a large guy. You played football in high school.
That's right.
And I just have always struggled to sort of envision you doing yoga. You don't strike me as the prototypical
right
yogi. Yeah.
Well, there are a lot of misconceptions, and part of it's our fault in yoga, that you have to be thin, light, and you're going to put yourself in pretzel poses. But yoga is not about tying yourself in knots. It's about untying the knots inside you.
Hmm.
So you do what you can with what you have, with where you are, as Teddy Roosevelt said.
Yeah.
And you use it as a tool to help yourself. It doesn't matter if you never do a pretzel pose. And I don't even teach them.
Mm-hmm. But your point is anyone can do them.
Anyone can do it. Well, we have wheelchair yoga. We have yoga for seniors. We have yoga for everybody.
Yeah.
Everybody should do it because everyone's going to feel better and behave better.
Max Strom's latest book, There Is No App for Happiness. Always a pleasure to have you here, Max.
And you.
Best of luck
so
with
much.
Your travels and all your teaching and everything else.
Thank you, Steve.